Okay, then why don't we begin? The title of our session this morning is Torture in History, organized around the question of what can we learn from history about the function and impact of the use of coercive interrogation techniques. Our two speakers are Professor Kathleen Coleman, who teaches in the Classics Department at Harvard, and Professor Darius Rajali, who teaches in the Political Science Department at Reed College. For this morning's session, we're going to have paper question and answer, then paper question and answer. So the speaker, Professor Coleman, will speak for about half an hour, and then we'll have about 10 minutes of questions, and then Professor Rajali, half an hour, and about 10 minutes of questions. The title of Professor Coleman's paper is The Fragility of Evidence, Torture in Roman Legal Thought and Practice.
Thank you, Bob. And thank you very much indeed to Scott Anderson and Martha Nussbaum for including history in this two-day conference and for inviting me to be one of its representatives. And I'm off the leash, as it were. I'm not in a community of classical scholars. I am learning from all of you, from whom I'm getting many perspectives which map in an extraordinary way right onto what the Romans thought they were doing with torture. And so I hope to bring some of that out in my presentation. Now, we have a question, which we've already had iterated once. I shall reiterate it. What can we learn from history about the function and impact of the use of coercive interrogation techniques? There is also a handout to accompany this talk. I'm using PowerPoint to illustrate the first half of my talk, to fill in the background, to give you the context. The handout accompanies the second part of the talk, which focuses on evidence for the Romans' own opinion about the function and impact of torture as an instrument of interrogation. And at the end, I'll revert briefly to PowerPoint to illustrate how the function and impact of coercive interrogation techniques were subverted by the Christian martyrs. And the modern scholars to whom I shall refer in this talk are listed at the beginning of the handout. Now, as some of you may be aware, the sources for anything we know about antiquity are extremely fragmentary. We have no tracts devoted to discussion of such practices as torture. And this is analogous to what we know about gladiators. There is no tract from antiquity talking about the institution of the arena and discussing gladiators, because it was an infradig, a non-you subject, not the sort of thing that the senatorial class, from whom most of our writings about antiquity have come down to us, would deem appropriate to discuss. So that when we're looking at something like torture, we have to piece everything together from very disparate incidental sources. We have no court proceedings describing interrogation under torture from the Roman world until we get down to the martyrdom of the early Christians. And as you can appreciate, the Christians themselves were circulating their versions of the court proceedings under which their fellow Christians were tortured, and therefore they are obviously a tendentious source. They're obviously going to be slanted to bolster the heroism of the martyrs and vilify the practices of the authorities. However, we do at least have some of those court proceedings, however edited they may have been. I've been very encouraged to hear so many stories told at this conference already, because our evidence for antiquity is really stories. So much of it is anecdotal, and they are anecdotes that usually focus on the inefficacy of torture and are deployed as a moral exemplum of bravery in the face of tyranny. So you can see already there's a slant to the evidence. But I shall be telling some of these stories, and I am, as I say, encouraged that the modern approach to torture has to rely so largely on stories also, because we don't have the kind of quantifiable databases on torture that we have for so many other social scientific inquiries today, because of its hidden secretive nature. So really, antiquity and modernity map very closely onto each other in that respect. Now, a little bit of mood setting. Here we have an extremely expensive and grand mosaic from a private house in Tunisia. And you will see there's a curious structure in the middle, which I shan't talk about. Around the perimeter, there are persons being mauled by leopards. You'll get a chance to look at this in more grisly detail in a moment. This comes from El Jem in Tunisia. It is the house of Seletius. This is the amphitheater mosaic. And as a little appetite whetter, if I may use that expression, here's a close-up of what was the bottom left-hand corner on the screen a moment ago. This is not somebody being tortured to extract evidence. This person is not being tortured at all. He's being executed. He clearly is different from even the slave who is propelling him towards his executioner. You can see the wild hair of the prisoner. This illustrates very graphically, I'm afraid, the Roman principle that persons who were other, and that is primarily the servile class, but also prisoners of war, foreigners who had no standing in Roman society and were not free peregrini in Rome, were subjected to these extravagant death penalties, and I'll have more to say about those in a moment. But I think it is important to see torture as an interrogation technique in antiquity in the context of the types of punishment that you could inflict upon the persons to whom it was appropriate to use coercive interrogation techniques also. So there's a good overlay, an exact parallel in Roman thought there, which I shall be trying to elicit in the course of my remarks. Now, in the absence of verifiable documentary evidence, what are we to make of the sources available to us? Well, I'm going to run briefly through some of the main categories of literary evidence from antiquity, starting with rhetoric. Cicero wrote, conducted a case against Verres, a governor of Sicily, in the 70 BCE, and Verres had mismanaged Sicily, and Cicero collected evidence in Sicily to indict him. And I'm going to read you a very brief extract from the second speech, the second section of the case, the fifth speech of the second actio, where the Sicilian fleet had been annihilated by pirates. The admiral Cleomenes had got off. His wife was having an affair with the Roman governor Verres, and that's why he got off, according to Cicero. The captains were arraigned, and Cicero, addressing Verres at his trial, describes what had happened to one of these people. One of these captains, I quote, was a certain Furius of Heraclea, for some of those folk have such Latin names as these, a man of note and distinction beyond the limits of his own town, even during his lifetime, and throughout all Sicily since his death. He possessed such courage as not only to denounce Verres without reserve, knowing himself a doomed man, he was aware that he risked nothing by acting thus, but with death looking him in the face, while day and night his mother sat weeping by his side in the prison, he composed a written speech in his own defense, and there's no one in Sicily today who does not possess this speech and read it and learn from it, Verres, the tale of your crimes and your cruelty. In it he tells how many sailors his town assigned him, how many exempted from duty, etc. These facts he stated before you in court, whereupon he was beaten across the face with rods. With certain death before him, he bore the pain calmly enough, loudly declaring what he has left us in writing, how foul a shame it was that the kisses of an adulterous woman should have more power to make you acquit Cleomenes than the tears of a mother to make you spare her own life, his own life. And I learn that he said another thing, a dying man's testimony to yourselves, gentlemen, which, if Rome is not deceived in you, was fully justified. Verres, he said, may kill the witnesses, but he cannot put justice to death. Powerful oratory. The speech, by the way, was never delivered. The entire second actio against Verres was a null and void because after the first speech, Verres saw the writing on the wall and took himself off into self-imposed exile in Marseille, actually, not a bad place to go. But Cicero published the speech. Because it was never actually delivered, skepticism is probably necessary, but the subtext to what he said reflects, nevertheless, the Roman principle that torture was not a regular procedure, at least for a Roman of free status. And I hope you noticed I stressed at the beginning Cicero's stress on the Roman name of this person, Furius. So he was a Roman citizen is the implication, and you don't do this to Roman citizens. Now, my next category is represented by the elder Seneca, who was a rhetor at Rome. He taught rhetoric, and the item that I'm going to quote from is a declamation, and this is a practice, a rhetorical exercise at Rome. Fortunately, some of Seneca's rhetorical exercises were published. The practice of declamation would prepare young Romans for the courtroom, and they would practice on very extravagant, invented, imaginary themes. And they're usually very sensational. And the theme that I want to focus briefly on is the theme of the woman who was tortured by the tyrant for her husband's sake. Okay. Now, on the handout, Victoria Pagan has written recently, very recently, about this declamation. I actually don't quite buy her argument, which is that she thinks the declamation shows some discomfort among the Romans about the concept of torturing a woman. I don't read it quite in that way, but I think it is important for us to look very briefly at what is said in this declamation. A wife tortured by a tyrant to find out if she knew anything about her husband's plot to kill him persisted in saying that she did not. Later, her husband killed the tyrant. He divorced the woman on the grounds of her barrenness. When she bore no children within 5 years of marriage, she sues him for ingratitude. That is the theme, and the brief extract describing the woman being tortured is what I want to quote to you now. The apparatus of cruelty is deployed against a miserable woman. The instruments that break the spirit even of men by their very look are set forth to extract the secrets in a woman's breast. The tyrant attacks with intimidation before torture, racks her with threats. She is silent. She sees the tyrant's set face, his threatening eyes. She is silent. She could have done you no greater service had she borne you children. Her limbs are cut by whips, her body broken by lashings, the blood forced out of her very vitals. She is silent. I don't know whether she will give children to the state. She has given it a tyrannicide. In other words, in Roman thought, torture creates examples of tyranny and resistance. And the person who's written so well about this is Roger Dunkel on your handout. Now, the next passage I want to talk to you about, I can, in fact, skip because very fortunately, Nancy quoted it yesterday afternoon, a passage from one of Seneca's letters. The passage is very graphic in talking about types of torture. What Nancy didn't stress so much, which I want to stress, is that this is used by the younger Seneca in the context of an argument about how man must not be enslaved to physical needs and afflictions, hunger, illness, pain, and so on. And so torture becomes a very useful example, once again, of resistance to any sort of physical or indeed mental coercion. So I'm going to skip over Seneca, because I know I'm not supposed to go over time, and talk very briefly about the younger Pliny, who I'm going to count here as a journalist, which might surprise some of you, but the younger Pliny, it would certainly surprise Pliny, but the letters of the younger Pliny were edited by him for publication, and today he published them in the New Yorker. That's the kind of thing we're dealing with. And one of Pliny's letters talks about the horrendous murder of a slave owner, Larcius Macedo, his name was, who himself was the son of a freedman. And he was attacked by his slaves. Pliny spends 11 lines talking about how they hit him in the face, the genitals, etc. And then they ran away, they were caught, and by implication they were tortured. And only 4 lines are devoted to the treatment of the slaves. But what Pliny says, I think, is really important. This horrible affair demands more publicity than a letter. Larcius Macedo, a senator and ex-praetor, has fallen a victim to his own slaves. Admittedly, he was a cruel and overbearing master, too ready to forget that his father had been a slave, or perhaps too keenly conscious of it. Then there's a description of the attack. The guilty slaves fled, but most of them have been arrested and a search is being made for the others. Makedo was brought back to life with difficulty, but only for a few days. At least he died with the satisfaction of having revenged himself, for he lived to see the same punishment meted out as for murder. There you see the dangers, outrages, and insults to which we are exposed. No master can feel safe because he's kind and considerate, for it is their brutality, not their reasoning capacity, which leads slaves to murder their masters. And that is an important detail, which I shall return to in a moment. We use novels also as a source of historical information from antiquity. There's a brilliant methodological discussion of how this can be done by Fergus Miller on your handout. Lucius in The Golden Ass is thought guilty of a robbery. His slave is automatically examined under torture. And they can't find Lucius because he's turned into a donkey in the meanwhile. Okay, so he escapes the notice of the authorities. But what is said about the treatment of Lucius's slave is important. The evidence pointing to Lucius as being the miscreant was not slight, I quote, but he'd made off at the very time when the crime was committed and has not been seen anywhere since. The assumption was that his slave, who was discovered in his lodging there, would reveal his master's crimes and future intentions. But though the magistrates had taken him into state custody and next day had inflicted sundry tortures on him, almost squeezing the life out of him, he had not made any such declaration. There's a slave being tortured for information. My last category is history. History written by Tacitus. A freed woman named Epicharis had played a key role in recruiting influential people to join the Pisonian conspiracy under Nero in 65 CE. The plot was revealed to Nero, and one by one, the key players named the rest, including Epicharis. And I shall now quote what Tacitus says. Meanwhile, Nero, recalling that on Volusius Proculus's information, Epicharis was being detained, and deeming her womanly body unequal to pain, ordered her to be mauled by torture. But in her case, neither beatings nor fires nor the torturer's anger, all the fiercer lest they be spurned by a female, prevailed over her denials of the imputations. Thus was the first day of Inquisition passed. On the next, when she was being dragged back to the same rackings by the conveyance of a chair, she was unable to stand on her own, on her dislocated limbs, she attached to the canopy of that chair in the manner of a noose, the banded fastening which she'd torn from her bosom, and inserting her neck and straining with the weight of her body, she expelled her now faint breath, a woman and freed woman defending by her more brilliant example in such an extremity others whom she scarcely knew, when the freeborn men and Roman equestrians and senators all untouched by torture were each betraying the dearest of those to whom they were bound. Even the one historical source among all the examples that I've cited to you, namely Tacitus, is not expressed with the objectivity that we would demand of documentary evidence. But there are common threads here. Interrogation under torture, when it is mentioned, is associated with slaves. Only in the case of Epicharis is it associated with a free person, in her case, freed. And this is in the context of an accusation of treason, whereby even the upper classes were deemed worthy to subjected to servile treatment. We do not get an explanation of why Nero did this to Epicharis other than Tacitus's remark that he deemed her womanly body unequal to pain and therefore thought she would be more susceptible to break down under torture. What one could argue that if there is something innate in a slave which makes him liable to torture, then the freed person can be, as it were, granted an exemption from the free person's unliability to torture because the freed person has the taint of the innate incapacity of a slave still sort of creating a smell around his or her person. But what we need to do now at this point is to try and identify what are the key features that make it permissible, indeed necessary, to torture slaves. 1,000 years of Roman history are not static, and punishment seems to have got more extreme from the mid to the late empire, as demonstrated in the work of Garnsey and MacMullan on your handout. Although Jill Harris has suggested that this apparent intensification is because our sources become more sensitive to violence and hence more critical of it. Alongside the apparent intensification of punishment, we see interrogation under torture spreading up the social scale. But it only happens in very isolated instances, as far as we can tell. We have to distinguish between torture as a means of interrogation and torture as an instrument of punishment. We have to distinguish between interrogation of witnesses to extract evidence and interrogation of suspects to extract confession. The basic distinction on which all this hinges is the distinction between a slave and a free person. Alan Watson is the one who's written the standard treatment of slave law in the Roman world. And the next distinction is the distinction between free aliens, peregrini, and citizens. The following sketch of the legal position regarding evidence given under torture is heavily reliant on the work, expert work, of Peter Brunt. Under the Republic, slaves could not be examined under torture to give evidence against their masters, though we see that in Apuleius, under the Empire, it is a fictional possibility. Therefore, Augustus brought in a law that enforced the sale of slaves in such cases so that they could be interrogated against their former masters. This expedient seems to have been limited to cases involving treason. Also under the Republic, all citizens were immune from torture. The status of freeborn foreigners, my peregrini, is not clear. It seems that under the empire, certain emperors subjected peregrini and even occasionally citizens to torture, as in the case of Epicharis under Nero, but once again there, the charge was treason. The dual penalty system gradually developed in the empire, whereby if you start being able to maltreat actual citizens, then you have to make the treatment of those who originally were subject to that type of treatment even more extreme, so that aggravated death penalties develop when, in the case of treason, you can try and extract evidence under torture from a free person or subject them to capital penalty for treason, then in the case of someone who is a slave or of some other lowly distinction, which develops after the whole empire gets citizenship in 212, all free persons get citizenship, then at that point the person of the lower status who dies for the same crime has to die with more pain, so that a distinction, social distinction, is retained. The image you have on the screen is from Zlitin in Libya. This is a mosaic, a small section of a frieze running around a central mosaic of opus sectile, cut marble pieces. And this shows you an ingenious method of subjecting of people to mauling by beasts with these cunning little chariot bases with long handles so that you can get the guy towards the executioner without subjecting the slave, who is the attendant, to risk at the same time. This is not an image of interrogation by torture, but of punishment by torture. Nevertheless, it is the backdrop to what follows. Question: who could be tortured and under what conditions? A slave to give evidence. A free person if charged with a severe crime, or to give evidence in cases of a severe crime. Question: what were the attitudes towards interrogation under torture? Please look at your handout. The first passage on the handout is by Cicero, and he is talking here about the interrogation of witnesses under torture. I will read what he says. If interrogation of witnesses under torture or the demand for such interrogation will help the case, first you must support the institution of interrogation under torture and talk about the efficacy of pain and about the attitude of our ancestors, who would undoubtedly have rejected the whole practice if they disapproved of it. You must also talk about the procedures at Athens and Rhodes, very civilized societies, in which a thoroughly repellent practice free men and citizens are tortured. We Romans are more civilized. We don't do that. Subtext. And you must talk about the procedures established by our wisest citizens, who, while they would not allow slaves to be tortured into giving evidence against their masters, did, however, think that torture should be employed in cases of incest and likewise in the case of conspiracy that occurred during my consulship. Cicero manages to get that in at every possible moment. The argument that is customarily used to undermine evidence extracted under torture should be laughed to scorn and declared formulaic and childish. There's an argument for torture. Okay? And note that there are two things that Cicero appeals to there. One is the efficacy of pain, and the other is mos maiorum, the customs of our ancestors. Note that Cicero here is writing a rhetorical manual to his son and treats interrogation under torture merely as a subsection of how one goes about conducting a court case. On the back of the handout, you have a definition of torture from the jurist Ulpian. By interrogation, we mean the application of torment and physical pain to extract the truth. And the verb there, eruo, to root out, is a very strong metaphor in Latin. Now, many of Ulpian's excerpts from his legal writing are contained in the digest assembled under Justinian in the 6th century. And so my last passage on the handout deals with that. You will see that in the middle of this section, which is a deeply fascinating section, a corollary to Cicero ridiculing the opponents of torture, here we have Ulpian saying, well, hang on a minute, does torture really work? No. And notice the part I've underlined, it is a chancy and risky business and one which may be deceptive. Fragilis. Some people resist, says Ulpian. There are a number of people who, by their endurance or their toughness under torture, are so contemptuous of it that the truth can in no way be squeezed out of them. Some people lie under torture to avoid pain. And this may lead to false recriminations. Here I'm in the middle of the passage. Others have so little endurance that they would rather tell any kind of lie than suffer torture. So it happens that they confess in various ways, incriminating not only themselves, but others also. Then section 24. Enemies usually under torture tell lies. Moreover, you should not place confidence in torture applied to a person's enemies because they readily tell lies. Not, however, that all confidence in torture should be lost where enmity is alleged. And then section 25, spontaneous admissions of guilt may be made out of fear, etc. Section 27. If a person should confess to wrongdoing of his own accord, he should not always be believed, for sometimes people confess out of fear or for some other reason. Now, I'm going to end with a very brief case study. Christian martyrdom has generated an enormous amount of scholarship, as you are all aware. I'm bypassing most of it to make one very particular use of one very particular piece of evidence. The transmission of the accounts of martyrdom is in many cases extremely muddled, with competing Greek and Latin recensions that contradict each other. But some of them, as I hinted at the beginning, appear to be based on the transcript of actual court records, how reliably we cannot know, and therefore have the potential to illustrate the function and impact of coercive interrogation in a very vivid way. So, very briefly, the acts of Euplius. These were court proceedings which took place, according to the Greek version, on the 29th of April in the year 304 under Diocletian. The Latin version gives a different date, still 304, but the 12th of August. The Latin version is much fuller. It's the Latin version I'm going to follow. This person, Euplius, appeared outside the courtroom in Catania in Sicily, carrying the scriptures which had been banned by Diocletian. He shouts out that he's a Christian. The governor, Calvisianus, invites him in, cross-examines him about the books he's carrying and where he got them from, and then tells him to read them. Euplius reads two verses from the Gospels of Matthew and Mark, and after further brief cross-examination, Calvisianus says, Okay? Since the admission of his crime is clear, let him be handed over to the torturers and questioned under torture. The purpose of the torture is to make him recant. The governor repeatedly promises to stop the torture if Euplius will recant by worshipping the gods of the traditional Roman pantheon. Eventually, the governor returns to his office, writes out a sentence of execution by beheading, and Euplius is executed with the gospel slung around his neck. Okay, so that's Tarlio, visiting an appropriate crime upon an appropriate misdemeanor. The gospels are the core of his crime, and they will be witness to and part of the display of his death. We don't know Euplius's background, though his name is Greek. We don't know whether he was a slave. We don't know how much of the transcript is authentic, but it's important for what it reveals about how torture was perceived. Some modern scholars emphasize that in its application to persons charged with the crime of Christianity, the aim of the quaestio, the torture, is not to prove that, as Lucy Grigg puts it, the Christian is a criminal and to persuade him to reveal his crime. Rather, the object is to force the accused to obliterate his crime. It's clear from the trial of Euplius, however, that from the perspective of the governor, the purpose is precisely to use torture as a means of interrogation to uncover the truth, to show that his confession that he's already made, in fact, he voluntarily said that he was a Christian, to show that that actually is not the truth, that the real truth is he does worship the gods, and this was just an aberration. And here's a brief exchange between the pair of them. The Latin is very vivid, so I'll put it up on the, put it up on the screen for you. While he was being tortured, Euplius said, "Thanks be to you, Christ, protect me who suffer for your sake." And Calvisianus' response is to say, "Stop this madness, Euplius, worship the gods, and you will set free. You will be set free." As Calvisianus sees it, Euplius is in the grip of insania, and interrogation under torture should make him admit the true state of affairs by agreeing to worship the traditional pantheon. From Euplius's perspective, his story has been consistent, torture or no torture, and no matter how guilty he is in the eyes of the worldly authorities, his consistency under torture has proven his innocence before God. Being a Roman citizen used to be protection from torture. Civis Romanus sum, I am a Roman citizen, as the poor citizen Gavius kept shrieking when he was being crucified by the wicked Verres, another passage from the fifth Verrine. Now Euplius repeats over and over again, Christianus sum, I am a Christian, which effectively overrides the efficacy of torture by aligning Euplius with the higher and supreme authority of God. The opposition between the ways of the world and those of heaven is a constant feature of early Christian texts, including the humblest of epitaphs. The paradoxical interpretation which the Christians imposed upon the practice of torture is vivid endorsement of Ulpian's verdict. In terms of what it is designed to accomplish, torture doesn't work. Thank you.
Striking, isn't it? The quaestio is defined even in terms of torture. And I was just wondering if you found any evidence of the more canny and indirect techniques of eliciting information, such as making friends with the person you're interrogating or anything of the sort that we've been talking about yesterday.
I've not found instances of that. And what I find so constant in our texts is the heroization of the victim and the stress upon the coercion and the physical pain in order to demonstrate that this can be withstood and create heroes, pagan heroes, and then Christian martyrs. Maybe I haven't looked far enough. I should confess to you all, I'm not a torture person, I'm a punishment person, and therefore I hadn't thought about torture till I got Martha's invitation. So I still have a lot of legwork to do, but this is my current take on it. Yes.
Thank you, that was fascinating. I was wondering, as you say, well, two questions. One is, I'm not sure I fully caught the business about the freed woman and the point. Was it that she was like a slave because she was a woman? Or was it that because she had been a slave, she still was slave-like in her.
Well, this is, yeah.
Both things?
The, what Tacitus says, and of course he's tremendously anti-Nero, what he says is that Nero decided to torture Epicharis because he thought, I'll read it again, meanwhile Nero, recalling that Epicharis was being detained and deeming her womanly body unequal to pain, ordered her to be mauled by torture. That's all that Tacitus says. I was suggesting that one reason why we occasionally find a freed person being subjected to torture might be the idea that something of the stench of their servile incapacity to tell the truth might still surround them after they have been manumitted and become slaves. I mean, this is something we were talking about at dinner last night. Bob brought up the very, very interesting point that if this is not a purely status distinction, but there's a sense that there's something inherent in the servile body, which is what Paige Dubois argues in something I didn't put on the handout because it's Greek, then you would say to yourself, well, how can that person change by the legal process of manumission? And what the sources, the Roman sources, stress all the time is the status distinction. But the passage that that ended the Pliny letter I thought was very interesting because it says that slaves are not rational and are cruel, and are, therefore any master is subject to attack by a slave. So there's a sense there that a slave lacks some sort of rational capacity and is therefore unreliable.
So what you're emphasizing is the innate, the possible, the deep at least, slave status, it doesn't easily get released. Ammunition.
That's what I'm suggesting.
As opposed to just the womanly, the female status here.
That's right. That was what I was trying to dig out, because we get so little actual statement about this from the Romans themselves.
And then just one other thought that you mentioned just in your closing remarks to Martha about the heroization
yes.
of endurance, which martyrdom clearly is. Is there a sense other than in the Seneca passage which you didn't read to us because I had it yesterday, a sense that it is the visuals, the paraphernalia and spectacles that are terrifying as opposed to the degradation or dehumanization, the things we heard being spoken about so movingly last night by Seth?
No, I think that the dehumanization and the humiliation is an extremely important part of torture and indeed of punishment in antiquity. And Seneca in that passage is talking about the, as you say, the how the very sight of these instruments of torture unsettles the self-control of the philosophical man and how he has to work at not letting himself be upset by that. But it's quite clear that humiliation is a key element and the working on the mentality of the person is a key element in both torture and in punishment, and I think the martyrdom of Eupolis illustrates this so vividly, because cutting his head off, obviously, is what's going to hurt physically, but hanging the Gospels around his neck so that everybody can see the Gospels there of this person completely helpless being eliminated is a humiliation to him, as well as, of course, being a potential deterrent to other people who might think, oh, I love the Gospels, you know, I'm going to read them on the street corner and so on. They might think, well, no, actually, better recant. That's, I think, part of the idea. But humiliation is terribly important in Roman penalty. There was a question somewhere there?
I'm sorry I wasn't here yesterday. I'm a little late in the game, so maybe this was discussed yesterday. It seems that I'd just like to hear you talk a little bit more about the punishment versus interrogation distinction and how the Romans saw that. It's very clear they're making distinctions based on the status of the person and type of the offense,
Absolutely.
Which resonate with us tremendously. But it's this sort of, you know, confusion of, or I'm still a little bit not clear about the use of torture to justify getting the information which is necessary to save the state, or use of torture as punishment because it's going to create the spectacle that will frighten other people into obedience to the law or something. I mean, how did the Romans articulate?
Right. Well, I think using torture to extricate information that can only be got cannot be got out by any other means, is very rare, actually, in Rome. Basically, getting information out of people under torture has to be applied to slaves. That's the way you get information out of slaves, is by torturing them. Very, very occasionally, like in this Tacitus passage, you get a free person being subjected to that kind of treatment. Remember that Tacitus is anti-Nero, and this passage would come with all the baggage of the tyrannical ruler attached to it. So that it's a way of Tacitus, without saying so, saying, look at Nero, he was so wicked. And the point about this, my slides, actually, with all the people being mashed up by leopards and so on, was to try and show you that the Romans were consistent in their treatment of these non-status persons. The dehumanization, remember the slave was a thing in antiquity, he wasn't a person, he was a possession. And therefore he can be treated in this unhuman way. And what is interesting is to see that interrogating him under torture maps onto the development of these aggravated death penalties. So that the slave or the prisoner of war will be eaten by a leopard when a citizen who'd done the same thing might just have his head chopped off. Okay.
Do we have time for one more question?
I don't know which one.
It may mention that during the course of the life of the Roman Empire, the torture seems to have been more common and worse. And I'm wondering, that doesn't seem to be necessarily to be the case in sort of the aging of a republic. And why would that be? What were the conditions that led to greater recourse to torture and uglier sort of mechanisms?
Well, I think one of the things is the edict in 212, whereby all free persons in the empire become citizens. And then you're going to want to make distinctions between groups of persons within that citizen body. Because, you know, I'm a Roman citizen, I'm from a patrician family, I'm in Rome, and suddenly I find, damn it, I'm on the same legal footing as that person who's a Syrian and, you know, can't read Latin and so on. He's now suddenly a citizen. So now we have to have further distinctions which will elevate me and give me a greater privilege above a person like that. And that seems to be when some of these more extreme penalties move slightly up the social scale. We get the distinction between honestiores, more honorable persons, and humiliores, the humbler persons. And people like soldiers get immunity, but many other people do not.
No, it doesn't have to do with an external threat.
I don't think so. There's an argument that, no, it's just that we've got more sources and we just see more vicious penalties. That's the Jill Harris argument. But I don't buy that either. I think penalties are becoming more severe. Christianity doesn't help at all. Christianity changes sexual mores in antiquity, but it certainly doesn't change the attitude to punishment. I'm afraid. Sorry. Thank you.
Our second speaker this morning is Professor Darius Rajali, who teaches, again, as I said before, in the Political Science Department of New College, and the title of his paper is Torture, Democracy, and Our Future.
Thank you so much. It is nice to be back. I remember the first time I was at the... Well, first of all, you should know that usually people are about as happy to see me as they're happy to see their dentist. I'm the empirical guy who sort of hangs out in the trenches and answers questions that make people really unhappy. The other thing is that the last time I was here, though, I know you guys were the first people who brought together all the torture experts in one place under Michael Geyer in 96. At that time, there were so few of us that you could actually put us all in a room like this. And it was wonderful because we hadn't seen each other ever. We would go up to each other and say, oh my God, you had the photo on Mazzotte on your refrigerator, you took that? You know, all these wonderful moments. The world has changed since I was last here. I wish it hadn't. As some of you know, while I was writing my book, Torture and Democracy, while I was writing my book, Torture and Democracy, in 2002, which was a very long project, I saw Dana Priest's first article on December 26, 2002. No one ever saw that article except me and Michael Ratner, I think. And I looked at it and I said, you know, we're gonna have a torture crisis. And I'm not going to finish chapters 14 through 18. I submitted my first draft is to be filled in when we have our torture crisis. As what's the point of doing this? And that's kind of work I do. It's depressing, but let me just say a few things about my work. It's Torture and Democracy is out there. It's this big 900-page book. I'm not going to be able to do it justice in 20 minutes. let me just begin with an observation from Walter Benjamin. You know, we are often asking ourselves questions these days like, why is torture still happening? And Benjamin tells us that, you know, whenever we ask the question, why is something still happening, it means that there's something wrong with the history we're telling and about our past. And there are a couple of things wrong with the way we think of our history. The first is, of course, that democracies shouldn't torture and don't torture, and in our minds that seems plausible because, well, the people elect politicians, the people don't like to be tortured, so if the politicians torture, they make sure that they don't torture. And if you believe that democracies are elite sham games, at least you know that, you know, the Democrats won't torture the Republicans when they're in power, the Republicans won't torture the Democrats when they're in power, and basically, as it's sometimes said, democracies are conceived to be bargains in leniency. But of course, as a matter of historical record, this is false. I think we've already heard about the Greek and the Roman conditions. The Italian conditions during the Renaissance were not much better. The French, the Americans, the British all tortured both at home and abroad. Well, less so the British, even before 1945. So it's not true. And our memory is kind of very peculiar about this. We tend to associate torture with Nazism, Stalinism. As the World War II poster said, which Andrew Sullivan just recently put on his website, torture is the method of the enemy. We fight to build a free world. And this kind of summarizes the problem, right? The problem is that when we came out of World War II, we developed, on the one hand, a very strong notion of human rights, 1948, the UN Declaration of Human Rights, at the same time, amnesia. Being morally pure was all about forgetting your past, forgetting about everything you did, and basically turning a blind eye even to practices of torture that existed within your own system. Most people don't remember when whipping was abolished in Delaware, 1961, the last case. Was for 10 lashes for wife battery on Red Hannah. She's still there. You want to see her. The Roman ferula, the whip that was actually used in these cases, flat broad whip was used in the Canadian prison system until 1972. Not so long ago. There are a lot of really interesting things about our amnesia. And I'm trying to give a history that both Torture and Democracy is both a history and then also a reflection on what was wrong with our social memory that we wanted to remember history this way. So it's a rather complicated work. But I do want to say one thing before I launch into my major sort of argument, which is that the democratic record is clearly one in which torture has a long, continuous spread, even though we've forgotten it. But it's not anywhere near as bad as the authoritarian one. The authoritarian states really deserve their reputation for enormous brutality on the scale that they have. Nevertheless, the connection between torture and democracy needs to be considered. It's not about whether it is, because obviously it has been, but under what conditions, how. And this then allows me to address two sorts of problems. One is, where does the demand for torture come in democracies historically over time, and where is the supply? Who comes running with the techniques? And lastly, of course, the question that I never thought I would actually have to write on, but which I ended up writing several chapters on, does it work? When I was finishing up my book, I realized, well, I just spent three summers mapping Gestapo torture technique by place, time, and agent. I know all the cases, so I can actually tell you how well it works, and if it works. So I did. Let me just talk a bit about demand, and I should actually get some water here. Your first thought is obviously national emergencies. That's where torture happens. You know, there's going to be some perceived threat, something that's going to drive people to torture. Yeah, there are cases like this in democracy. They probably account for about a third of the cases that we know. Torture actually happens in a number of other contexts. Besides the national security model, there's the civic discipline model, which basically torture is a kind of local arrangement to induce civic discipline. I don't need to explain that certain people can't cross certain parts of the city from one side to another when Commander Burge was doing his business here. So that's a pretty good example. You can find examples like that everywhere throughout the world, and especially in democracies. It tends to be closely related to property holders and business people coming to basic agreements with cops. The other sort of very obvious sources that you can have judicial systems that have peculiarities that draw out torture, very well-known phenomenon, long-term detention. Albie Sachs illustrated this for us yesterday. Long-term detention without remand before a judge or any explanation, highly correlated with the emergence of torture, and also a system in which confessions, for whatever reason, are valued over all other forms of evidence, that there's a sort of fetishism of the confession. My favorite example for this is the Japanese system. The Japanese Bar Association identified several hundred cases of torture in the 1970s and 1980s. One of the striking features of the Japanese system is the importance of confessions. 86% of all crimes in the Japanese system end with a full confession by the accused. That's huge. It's down 99% in 1940. Once you have a system that values confessions, police will get the confession for you any other way. If you have long-term detention, which the Japanese have, called betten taiho, that will also do it to you. And you don't need to have an emergency or a perceived threat or anything. And many, many cases of torture are like that. And so basically, and there's one last point which I will make, is that there's no really sharp distinction between domestic and international cases, national security, and the civic discipline and judicial models. One of the striking things is decommissioned soldiers who torture abroad bring their techniques back. Commander Burge learned many of his electrical techniques, let's say that they're alleged, but in any case, the techniques used in Chicago were techniques that were well known in MPs on the south side of Vietnam. Soldiers bring their techniques home, not hard to imagine. What are you going to get a job as when you've been an MP? You're going to become a cop or a private security person. We all know about waterboarding. What you don't know is that waterboarding, as you all know, in that Harper's piece, New Yorker piece that came out, was from the Philippines, or at least that style of water torture. I'm going to be more specific. And it soon appears between 1902 and 1930 in prison and police systems all through the American South in military context. It displaces an older form of water torture, which was used primarily on scolding women, called ducking. And the last person who was ducked in United States was a woman by the name of Miss Mary Brady at Jersey City. She was officially ducked by law, as was Miss Annie Pope in Ottawa. Canadians are never exempt about these things, and it's important to recognize that. One of the things that torture and democracy does is actually nobody escapes this. Whether you're gay or not, I'm going to talk about the torturers and the Nazis who were gay, and all sorts of other issues that come up. Nothing takes you on quite a bizarre journey as torture. Decommissioned soldiers have brought torture back twice, and likewise in France, same thing. It was not the Nazis who invented electrical torture. The French were using electrical torture back in Vietnam in 1931. It was Vichy police who introduced it to the Gestapo in 1943, a man by the name of Pierre Marty, colonial inspector from Tunisia. Things come home, and the odds are that the things that we have seen in this war are likely to come home. Sad news, 20-year shadow, don't lose my book, you're gonna need it. So much for the supply side. Demand side. Supply side. We think that the supply of torture is usually tied to the abnormal nature of the torturers. They chew stuff as is their nature. Sadly, not true. Torture systems typically choose organization men to do the torture. They're fairly normal. We have about 7 studies now of torturers and what happens to them after they torture, which is not very pretty. One of the things we have learned is that not only do torturers like terrorists before organization men, they don't like sadomasochists who don't take rules seriously. But additionally, torture is a craft. Historically, it's been taught. It has styles. One of the things I've been doing for the last 12 years has been, as I suggested to you, mapping torture techniques around the world, not by country, but by place, time, and year. I don't care whether you call these torture techniques or not. You can call them tough stuff, muffin stuff. I just want to know how the stuff passes on. For example, it's not very happy work. It's kind of boring work, you know, mapping leg clamps through Gestapo leg clamp practice through Western Europe takes a long time. You discover that it's more common in northern France and Norway and Belgium than anywhere else. You think, well, what's the point of all that? Well, the first point is that when you do the entire pattern, you discover that very few techniques that we now call modern torture are things that came from Nazis, Stalinists, or the Inquisition. I know water torture, the Inquisition, and there are some rare cases that have traveled forward, and I'm happy to explain why. Actually, leg clamps and whips, which was the standard Nazi practice, you can't find leg clamps anywhere these days. Now, I've already implied what my main argument is going to be, that basically you can divide torture into 2 types of things, clean and scarring techniques. And the sad news is that or the good news is, I don't know how you want to look at it, scarring techniques are disappearing worldwide. Some of them have completely disappeared. And clean techniques continue. And there are certain combinations of techniques that are repeated, what I've called styles, because as tailors and massage therapists, there's Swedish massage, there's other kinds of massage. Torturers also have styles, traditions. And there are 2 main traditions of torture today, the French modern and Anglo-Saxon modern. French modern is the classic combination of electricity and water torture. You see that in the movies. I've already told you where it comes from. Anglo-Saxon modern is the combination of sleep deprivation, exhaustion techniques, stress, what we call stress and duress, forced standing, forced kneeling. Components, but these have seen huge circulation. Why are these valuable? Again, Alby Sachs illustrated this point with sleep deprivation. They're valuable because, on the one hand, they leave no evidence, and it's very hard to persuade people that you were in tremendous pain. They create this break between your ability to communicate your pain to your community. It interrupts the political expression of pain. And then the question is why? And the central claim that Torture and Democracy makes is that the reason that you get the weird pattern that you see is because torture, the diffusion, the supply side of torture instruments is related to something that we almost never think about, which is public monitoring. Basically, where there are healthy civil societies, torturers become sneaky. When we watch, torturers become sneaky. It's one of the perverse effects of external human rights monitoring. And basically, you find these clean techniques first appear in democracies where there are church groups, bad press, and so forth, and they spread roughly after 1960 as the emergence of a global civil society and human rights regimes and international auditing and so forth. Electricity, which is the main example in the book, it's a very hard technique to use. Why would you use it if you can whip someone? You really wouldn't unless there are some very specific reasons. Basically, between 1945 and 1960, there are about 9 countries in the world who use it. In the 1960s, 18. 1970s, 40. In the 1980s, 80. And rising. And the trend pattern begins in Latin America, then moves to Asia and the Middle East, then Africa in the 80s, and most recently in the 90s, Southern and Eastern Europe. So that sounds kind of depressing, but the good news here is that obviously torturers care. They care more about human rights monitoring than you do, perhaps. they pay attention. And that's one of the really important results of what my work is that they actually care. They will, and as torture has become less visible to your eyes and my eyes, there are a group of doctors I know who spend a lot of time trying to diagnose these things. And so there are new forms of visibility that are coming to play. Believe it or not, until 1993, we couldn't distinguish medically between an electrical injury and a burn. But now we can. It's somewhat problematic, but and so torturers, faced with new forms of visibility, now kill the doctors. No big surprise that the as medical professionals, as torture becomes less visible, health professionals become mobilized. Health professionals then end up on the front lines of these battles, and no surprise in every direction. So. 5 or 7 minutes?
Or? Yeah, sure.
Okay, I can't, I'm going through an enormous amount of information. I apologize if I go too fast. Now I turn to the question of does it work? I'm sure all of you have some questions. I'm sure I'm not gonna be able to answer all of them. And actually what I say will be disturbing. So I know yesterday there were a lot of questions about the empirical nature of torture, and I have to say many times I was like, oh no, you can't say that, oh well, you know, and it was both in the audience and in the presentations, but I'm happy to explain what my perspective on these things are. Does it work? Does it work to get false confessions? Absolutely. Although you'd be surprised how low the rate is. But I'm willing to stipulate that because that's not the interesting question. Although it's very difficult to get people to lie. And there's really interesting psychological reasons for it. Secondly, does it work to get behavioral compliance? Yes, one can stipulate that, but it's not really interesting again. The real question is whether it gets true intelligence. And this is where inevitably, as you correctly point out, everybody gets into storytelling. And storytelling has its places in the study in social science. I will be happy to tell you a few stories of my own. But my favorite example is, it happens all the time, actually. I give a talk like this, and afterwards an old World War II veteran, usually not an academic audience, it's a much broader audience, World War II veteran comes up and says, when we were in France in 1943, we got this Nazi soldier. The medic in our company took a knife, held it to his neck, and said, where are the troops? And I said, did you get good info? And he said, sort of. And I said, no, I'm glad. I sincerely, sincerely am glad. Because if you've gotten bad info, you'd be dead. You would be dead. And it's important to understand this. The people who know torture doesn't work are dead. The people who are alive are the ones for whom torture worked. So the testimonials are a skewed sample set, is what we'd call. So I'm sure you can find lots of people who survived, right? But that's a silly argument. There's a use for testimonials. I'm happy to talk about the way we can think about them. But what we'll have to look at are the cases where we actually have databases. And Torture and Democracy goes through 3 or 4 of those surprising databases, remarkable databases that survived government secrecy and efforts to destroy them and all sorts of really interesting things. But I'll just rush to the main point. For torture, for good torture, torture to work, you first of all have to arrest somewhere between 8,000 to 20,000 people and torture all of them. Best case scenario, based on the cases I'm looking at, 34 to 78 innocents have to be tortured or killed for each one hit.
Say it again.
Yeah, I know.
Just back up.
Yeah, it's 8,000 to 20,000 that you have to arrest. I'll give an example. 80 to 20,000 in your pool, you have to torture all of them, and you're going to get 34 to 78 innocents. That's the cases we know that you have to torture or kill for your one accurate bad guy. Now, bottom line is you, for every accurate bad guy or piece of information, you have to torture in the thousands. People said that, but I actually have the number, and that's as close as we're going to get. There are problems with my data. I'm happy to talk about them, but that's as close as the data is going to get. This cases that I'm looking at involve sometimes the most scientific approaches for picking prisoners for interrogation, but the bottom line is good torture is a wholesale, not a retail business, and so is good not torture. Whatever we want to call what we're doing is also a wholesale, not a retail business. And to pretend that it's a ticking time bomb thing, well, we can talk about that. These are best case scenarios. I'm making assumptions about what factors are at work. And I think David Sussman is correct that really my weird conclusion is that the Dashner case is about the only case where we could plausibly talk about torture working in ways. Basically, torture works best in peacetime, and whether you can justify it or not is up to you, and that was what David was exploring. But if you do torture in war, those are the results. The ones I gave you are the ones that are, in fact, the ones that we see. So you tell me, does torture work? Well, the Japanese fascist military police, the Kempei Tai, gave us their answer in an interrogation manual in Burma. For intelligence, torture is, quote, the clumsiest method. And these are not people who hesitate torturing. But they do so for purposes of intimidation and false confessions, but not for intelligence. Example, 1943, assassination of Richard Heydrich, Reich's protector of Bohemia and Moravia. Hitler wanted results. He didn't care how. He wanted the bad guys and the terrorists taken care of. And they did indeed get all three of the resistance members who killed Heydrich. The record shows that they were very methodical, and the Gestapo arrested, tortured, and killed 7,545 people, including annihilating the villages of Lidice and Lazaki. In addition to the three guys, they got probably incidentally about 100 more resistance people generally that they weren't looking for, but if you want to move the goalposts, fine. And these are results that are roughly comparable with the Battle of Algiers or the Project Phoenix in Vietnam. History, and I actually am happy to tell you logically why it's inevitable that this is going to be the result, not just historically, but there are actually causal reasons why this actually happens in this way. In the middle of all this, Heinz von Panwitz, the anti-sabotage director of the Gestapo units, arrived and he said, "You guys are crazy, stop torturing." We all know that professional policing depends on anti-sabotage, depends on public cooperation. And let's put out a reward. And indeed, the case was not broken by torture. It was, in fact, broken by a man named Korda, who thought, you know, I think I'll take that reward. And he walked in, and he handed over the resistance. He was the key factor. Korda was not tortured. He knew he wouldn't be tortured. And he came in. But the problem was that by 1943, the real professionals in the Gestapo were dying. They were being lost in war, and there were a bunch of young kids on the block who liked to carry bats. One of the characteristics of torture complexes is deprofessionalization, and basically the Gestapo's over-reliance on torture in the last years of the war was, in fact, a decline in its overall professional standing. Subsequently, a not large number of government studies have gone into, and by the way, I'm not interested in whether the question torture works. I'm actually interested in what works. Presumably, we all want good counterintelligence to stop terrorism. And the answer is, Panwitz is right. Social scientists have already identified large-end studies, government-funded, America, England, Canada, without public cooperation, the chances that a crime will be identified or cleared falls to less than 10%, no matter what other things you throw at it. Interrogation, more money for cops, more people out on the streets. We know what works for proper intelligence building is public cooperation. Even authoritarian states know that, and they prefer to get their intelligence, if they can't get it from the public, through informant systems. Everyone knows East Germany, 1 out of 80 people was an informant, or so I understand. There are a lot of other things I could talk to you about. I will be happy to answer questions, but having told you about, there's so many sleep deprivation and waterboarding, so many things we could talk about, but I will say one other thing because it's come up, which is the regulation of torture. Torture in Democracy has a whole chapter which I go through various ways in which torture was regulated from the Greeks and the Romans to the present. It looks at both forms of regulative failure and why regulative failure happens. There are slippery slope effects. There are three, actually torture doesn't have a slippery slope. It has three slippery slopes. Each of these can be empirically documented. The first, and they're not logical slippery slopes, they're driven by standard causal mechanisms. There are about 8 causal mechanisms that drive this. The first slippery slope is the number, and I think you gave an example of this, the number of victims and the types of victims expands over time. The second is that the types of techniques also expand over time. And the third is bureaucratic devolution, where the torturers become less responsive to rules from the center. And it turns out, not only do these three slopes happen in virtually all cases of regulated torture we know, they are much more severe in counterinsurgency conditions for a variety of very specific reasons having to do with counterinsurgency warfare. So, that's all I will say. I'm happy to take questions now. But I'll say one more thing. We shouldn't be stupider than the professional Gestapo, the Kempe Tai, and the Spanish Inquisitors. What we really need is to change conditions so that publics support us. We need protection for whistleblowers. We certainly need to recognize the cost of torture for torturers. I know people don't like to hear this, but in veterans hospitals in Virginia, there are lots of people who were doing prison detail. We don't pay for their care, and we really need to confront the cost which we have asked our soldiers to bear, which we don't want to acknowledge. We don't want to acknowledge that Command Specialist Darby, who broke the Abu Ghraib crisis, still lives in fear, as do all other whistleblowers. So we need to focus, lastly, on human intelligence, which is clearly the only way forward, and I'm happy to argue my case on a strictly consequentialist basis. Thank you. Yes.
Okay, I'll be quick. Thank you very much, that was really informative. And I look forward to reading the book. Two quick points that haven't come up, and I'd like your input onto them. I've been privy to reading a 7 or 8 volume correspondence with a liaison worker, or a officer, United States officer, who's, and by liaison is a person who holds an office in the United States military, but works with foreign governments. And his view throughout, where he says we don't torture, he's still in service, is that he uses the softened up folks from others. So there's an issue, I'm just wondering if you could address a little bit, which we haven't talked about complicity, where you're on the more passive side, but certainly not at the periphery of the activity. And then the other one I wanted to just ask about is creative techniques, again, from talking to soldiers and interrogators, the low-level ones, the officers who give command says, well, you can't really control what the young guys do. We heard this rogue activity, et cetera. So, you know, especially if they have police backgrounds, the reservists who come in with police backgrounds. So presumably there's some range of, this is an interesting trick, let's try this within a fairly bureaucratic institutionalized practice.
Okay.
So just if you could comment.
By the way, how much time do we have for questions, or are we at time?
We have about 8 to 10 minutes.
Okay.
What do you know about liaison and then rogue stuff?
I don't know anything about liaison, although I'm also feeling like I'm not understanding your concern there, so maybe we can talk afterwards. It's kind of interesting. As some of you may know, in 1938, the Nazis, the there were strict regulations for how torture should be done by the Gestapo. And there were forms and all sorts of things that should have been done. And then they were reissued in 1942 with a somewhat broader understanding by Gestapo Chief Mueller. Andrew Sullivan put that memo out there. And I would say that one thing that you might want to consider is when you read it, it looks a lot like something that we would see today. The only authorized Gestapo practices are sleep deprivation, beating with a stick no more than 20 times, provided that a medical officer is present. You should never be tortured for the purposes of your own incriminating yourself. You should only be tortured for crimes against the state, only specific sorts of status of individuals. It's a really fascinating document because, of course, it bears absolutely no relationship to what actually Gestapo officers did. And at Nuremberg, when the French and Russian prosecutors brought the case of torture against Gestapo, there was actually only one conviction on torture, and that was for Kaltenbrunner in the camps, because uniformity of technique implies uniformity of intent. Other than that, Gestapo torture all over Europe was incredibly variable, and for a variety of very specific reasons. Whereas, by the way, Kempe Thai technique was actually uniform across East Asia. And part of the reason for this is that the Gestapo actually farmed out, they farmed out interrogation to private military contractors. The French Gestapo was much more interesting. And so everybody brings their own national and cultural techniques. Our national and cultural techniques come from surprisingly, or not surprisingly, movies, frat houses. There's a really interesting process. If you watch the few people who have been tortured, and you see their first statements when they're first arrested, they will, like the guy who killed General Mohush, he'll say, I learned my technique because my brother stuffed me in a sleeping bag. And when he gets to allocution, he says, I got this from Siri. Which is the survival escape resistance camps of, yeah. So, exactly. So, they change their stories as they go on. I think you need to understand that we are nowhere near in understanding where American soldiers got it, but the general pattern historically is fairly clear. The top authorizes and the bottom comes running with its own techniques. Maybe I'll do two or three questions at once. Yeah.
Well, it does seem that your that Vice President Cheney knows your figures, and he's aiming to unveil. I was troubled by your very last line, that you want to know what works and you want good intelligence, because you began by saying that our stories aren't correct. And I don't think we've confronted the history of our own nation well enough, by which I mean that we're not simultaneously realistic enough and we are not modest enough. Look at something like the war in Vietnam, retrospectively, and recognize it as a crime for which very few people went to jail.
Mm-hmm.
And so it troubles me to think that what we still are looking for, in your mind perhaps, is good intelligence that will get the terrorists, as opposed to some understanding of who those people we're calling terrorists are and what they actually believe, and what their case against us is. I remember Clinton calling Suharto our kind of guy.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I'm deeply sympathetic. One of the ways in which I actually begin my talks sometimes is to say, look, in fact, I was just being interviewed by BBC Farsi. I'm Iranian by descent, and I'm not just any kind of Iranian. She said, wait a minute, how do you know this much about torture? What kind of Iranian are you? And I said, who would know more about torture than the grandsons of princes? My great-grandfather tortured people who he considered to be terrorists and anarchists. He had absolutely no problem. This is my family. Last night with Albie Sachs, one of the things that my own experiences, and I thanked him for it, is that for those of us who actually came out of those kinds of worlds, this is not an academic question, but it's also not a moral and blame question either. There are people. I lost my life by leaving Iran because of Muslim fundamentalists. So I am willing to stipulate that Al-Qaeda wants to kill me. and we do want to stop that. What I would like is better policing. And yes, absolutely, there should be culpability for all violations of international norms. I have no problem with that either, because those two things go together. Yeah.
Online
because everything that he describes in the book was already being done in the 1930s. Al and I probably clearly have, we've been on conferences together, we probably have some areas of agreement and some areas of disagreement about whether torture is a science as a craft. But I would point out the following things. If torture is a science, then it should work. And if it doesn't work, then it's not a science. If torture is a science, it should not have slippery slopes. The reason that you find the slippery slope is partially because of the nature of pain. And we don't have a, if we had a science of pain, it wouldn't have this runaway effect. I'm happy to explain that too, but basically over time, your body has physiological capacity to shut down your ability to sense pain. Sensory deprivation, particularly high volumes of white noise, have the effect of instantaneously reducing your capacity to feel pain. Not exactly what I would use if I was going to torture someone. So there are a number of empirical problems with this sort of claim, which the psychologists would say. And there's a fact that Al himself acknowledges, which is that most practices in the world are actually not scientific. They're low grade, and they're low grade for a very important reason. They need deniability. And then if you want to make that argument about scientific equipment breaks, you know, you can't, and besides, it's completely visible. If you set up a sensory deprivation chamber in your basement, the amnesty is going to find it, right? I mean, God, we wish we had the days of Iron Maidens where we could identify these things. We're going to miss them. The point is that whether you think torture is a craft or a science, there are a whole series of debates we could have about this empirically. But I think on the broader scale, I think Al and I agree that torture doesn't work, that it has these fundamental slippery slopes. I think the causal mechanism is different. Even if Al is right about that very specific component of American torture, the work that I have basically says that that probably accounts for probably one fraction of a minuscule of actually the torture that's out there in the world today.
One more.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. I'll take several. One, yeah.
In passing about the British not having a better record, what did you think about?
I will be happy to answer that, but let me take a few more. Yeah.
In your account of how scarring torture increases as public or civic participation increases, reminded me of he's always criticized for not doing real historical work or not doing empirical research to back up his claims. And so on the one hand, it seems to me like you may have done that. But on the other hand, he's also criticized for not prescribing anything. And so the question comes up, if increased civic participation causes these shifts in torture, it doesn't, is more civic participation still possible?
Those are the same question. One more. Yes.
I'm interested in variation in two different contexts. One, what explains the variation in democracies' torture? You make the important point in your talk in your book. Techniques come from democracies, or democracies and cleaning techniques, not scarring techniques, but not all democracies equally. And secondly, the numbers that you throw out about 34 to 78 strike me as suspect for the reason of the variation. Surely some techniques.
Well said. You can't answer the question torture works because torture is basically a moral category, right? What we want to ask is, does sleep deprivation work? Does waterboarding work? They're close to about 35 empirically if you want to ask that question. And yes, some of them are worse, but the ones that are worse are the ones that we call not torture, which we now do. Sleep deprivation, my favorite. There wasn't an inquisitor in the 18th and 17th century that would go near sleep deprivation. They knew that sleep deprivation, what modern psychologists know, that sleep deprivation not only causes pain, and as Menachem Begin says, is equivalent to, it's worse than starvation, I believe was his quote. He was subjected to it himself. But additionally, it makes you highly suggestible. And it creates a hypnotic effect on repeated questioning. So it's ideal for Scottish witch hunters who have these wonderful visions of of the devil and all sorts of things. And you have, actually, it's one of the rare moments when you're reading the text of Spanish inquisitors who they begin to sound like social scientists. And they're like, just these Scots, they're crazy. Give me the rack any day, you know? So, there's a huge variation. Basically, there are three fundamental problems with accuracy. One is that you could have the wrong person. We've talked about this, the selection problem. The second is, even if you break the person and he is the right person or she is the right person, it's impossible to know, or very few of us are very good at it. Our capacity for actually being able to distinguish between truth and lies is about 45 to 55%. Psychologists have tested police and all sorts of people on this. 50% is the flip of a coin. Sometimes you're actually better off just flipping a coin in answer to your questions. And then the last one is, if the particular type of torture technique causes cognitive problems, because anything that inhibits the power of the brain to withhold information also has the power to distort the brain's capacity to retrieve information. And so particularly dangerous are all those that affect the brain cognitively, which is a significant chunk of the torture techniques we're talking about. The other two questions, if I may suggest, are actually both the same. External monitoring has sometimes been able to reduce torture, and I certainly wouldn't want to suggest it's ineffective. When governments, the problem is not to stop torture. Stopping torture, which is what the British were quite capable of doing and what we did after World War II, quite capable, really requires some very simple steps. We all know what these steps are. They're very easy to implement. Basically, strong leadership for rules, punished for violation of the rules, regular medical inspections, and remand before a judicial authority within 24 hours will pretty much get rid of all torture within your system very fast. And the British were absolutely punctilious about this. And so their professional capacity was very important. More civic participation is in itself is not a good thing, although it can help more external monitoring. When Amnesty International works together, or Human Rights Watch works together with a country or a government that wants to clean up its prison system, it actually is very fast. Authoritarian states in Eastern Europe were able to stop torture on their own. This is not about democracy. Let's be clear. You can be many authoritarian states also realized precisely the problems that I'm talking about and ended torture themselves. The Brazilians recognized that the devolutionary capacity of torture was so terrible that they actually turned their military on their torture units and killed them. And this is one of the central problems with the Military Commissions Act. It envisions a parallel system. Some people can torture and some people can't. The moment that you create parallel systems like this, torture will seep across that line. There will be all sorts of interesting competitive implications for this. It's going to be a disaster. Good luck.